Welcome to Food for Thought, sponsored by Carlson Laboratories. Listen now as your host, Jolie Root, sifts through medical research and expert opinions for practical advice to help you take control of your health naturally and live well every day. And now, here's your host, Jolie Root.
Good morning and welcome to Food for Thought. I'm here with you and we've got a brain show coming up. A lot of good information about how to have a healthy mind, how to feed and nourish a healthy brain. But there's some nutrition in the news also that I think is worth mentioning. And one of the studies that was a little troubling actually was about alcohol consumption. And it found that for middle-aged individuals, heavy alcohol consumption increases the risk of stroke even more than being diabetic. It's well known that having high blood pressure increases the risk of stroke and that being diabetic raises the risk of having a stroke, but there's a factor that increases the risk even more, and that is the tendency to consume too much alcohol. Heavy drinking in midlife was found to raise the risk of stroke by 34% compared with light drinking. So we're not just talking about any level of consumption of alcohol. We're talking about the different and heavy. So more than a third. It increased the risk of stroke by more than a third having more than two alcoholic drinks per day during middle age. Now there are close to 800,000 people in the U.S. every year that have a stroke. Stroke causes 130,000 deaths every year. It makes it one of the leading causes of death. Smoking increases the risk, having very elevated cholesterol, having high blood pressure, being diabetic. Those are all well-known risk factors for stroke. But this actually showed that particularly during the middle years, increased alcohol consumption beyond that of two drinks per day dramatically increased the likelihood of having a stroke. And the age that was going on was in their 50s and in their 60s. People who engaged in heavy drinking in their 50s and 60s were likely to suffer a stroke around 5 years earlier age-wise than people who were light drinkers. Light drinkers is half a drink a day. So this is just something to think about. We know that drinking alcohol, the tendency to drink more increases in midlife. So we shouldn't have the attitude that, well, I got to this age, what could hurt me now, when it comes to certain behaviors. It's really important to pay attention to alcohol consumption and not just think that if a little bit is good, more is better. In the case of drinking, that's not the case. Now, another study that I found somewhat troubling, because it feels like sometimes there's no way to avoid this exposure to pesticides and exposure to a particular pesticide. It was found that a commonly used pesticide may alter the development of the brain's dopamine system. The dopamine system is responsible for emotional expression and cognitive function. And altering that system increases the risk of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children. So this was published in the Journal of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology. This was Rutgers and Emory got together with the University of Rochester Medical Center and Wake Forest. And it was an animal study, but what they found was exposure to the pyrethroid pesticide methrin while the mom mouse was pregnant and breastfeeding. Those babies exhibited several features of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, including dysfunctional dopamine signaling in the brain, hyperactivity, working memory problem, attention deficits, and impulsive behavior. So we know that young humans are exposed to hundreds of chemicals in utero, And there, we can't change the genetic susceptibility to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but there may be modifiable environmental factors. We certainly want to pay attention to vitamin D and omega-3, as I will talk about a little later in the program. But this disorder affects children and adults. 11% of children between the ages of 4 and 17. Boys are 3 to 4 times more likely to be diagnosed than girls. We are beginning to think that estrogen's protective function in the brain, preserving serotonin function, might be one of the reasons for that. But early symptoms of attention deficit include an inability to sit still, an inability to pay attention and follow directions. Those symptoms usually begin between the ages of 3 to 6, and the diagnosis is usually made when the child is beginning to attend school full time. In this study, the exposure to pesticides was more toxic to the male mice than the female mice. But this pesticide is not considered to be particularly toxic, and it is typically used on golf courses, in homes, in gardens, lawn and vegetable crops. So it's something to think about. It's a pyrethroid pesticide, and we do need to pay attention to pesticide exposure. Children with higher exposure to those metabolites, the pesticide metabolites, were twice as likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. So this mouse study then went back and analyzed humans. The Centers for Disease Control and the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey information was analyzed, and they cross-referenced the kids' use of ADHD medicines and then did urine studies for pesticide metabolites. Pregnant women and young children's bodies don't metabolize environmental chemicals as quickly as adults and people who and women who are not pregnant. So yet another reason to be very careful about the chemicals that we use in our homes and in our gardens, and also, if at all possible, eating organic, selecting organic products, cooking oils, places where chemicals will concentrate. Lipids, fats are a place, so cooking oils, that's a particularly good thing to choose organic versions of. There was a study this week that talked about extra virgin olive oil and the phenolic compounds killing cancer cells. There's chemistry in extra virgin olive oil. The first pressing, these oils have the highest levels of these phenolic compounds, and the organic oils obviously are the best choice there. So where you have choices about where to maybe spend a little extra food-wise in your food budget, cooking oils, using olive oil, using organic extra virgin olive oil makes a lot of sense. But being very careful about pesticide exposure is something that will continue to be important. Now, there was another exciting study that showed that a particular supplement, vitamin K — I don't talk about vitamin K that often. It works together with vitamin D in the body. And this was a study that was published in a journal called Thrombosis and Hemostasis. And what they found was that long-term supplementation with vitamin K2, 180 micrograms daily — that's a pretty small amount — taking that for 3 years was associated with inhibiting age-related stiffening of artery walls. This was in postmenopausal women. This is pretty exciting. Vitamin K2 supplements improving arterial function in healthy women. These were healthy postmenopausal women. And what happened was the women that took that little dose of vitamin K2 had improvement of vascular elasticity. This is a good thing. Nice, flexible, elastic, stretchy blood vessels. Those are youthful. The women who took vitamin K2 did not experience the typical age-related progression of arterial wall stiffening. They actually had improvement of vascular elasticity compared to the placebo group. So what that demonstrates is that a nutritional dose of vitamin K2 could improve cardiovascular outcomes. So K2 is typically produced in the gut by microflora. So this is a reason to make sure that your gut health is good, that you don't have inflammation in the gut, that you're taking probiotics. And vitamin K1 is actually found in green leafy vegetables like lettuce and broccoli and spinach. That's 90% of the vitamin K in our typical diet. But they took a few hundred healthy postmenopausal women and gave them vitamin K2 supplements for 3 years, and they measured cardiovascular effects. Pulse wave velocity and stiffness, arterial stiffness, so improved elasticity. And they measured markers for vascular stiffening, and there was half as much. And in some women, there was improvement. They didn't see changes in markers for inflammation, but they did see improvement in the elasticity of the blood vessel. So this same group of people were also in a study that was published 2 years ago in a journal called Osteoporosis International, because vitamin K it produces positive changes in bone health also. And that's where vitamin K and vitamin D work together. They work together for cardiovascular health and the health of blood vessels, but they also work together for improved calcium metabolism. Vitamin K ensures that calcium binds to the bone mineral matrix. It's kind of a scaffolding inside the bone, improving bone density. And when it binds in there, in the bone mineral matrix, that keeps it out of the arteries. This is important because if calcium accumulates in the arteries, it can cause stiffness and blockages that lead to serious cardiovascular events like heart disease and stroke. One of the experts that was quoted in this study is somebody that's actually a friend of mine, Dr. Dennis Goodman. He's the director of integrative medicine at NYU's Langone Medical Center in New York. And so this is important research. Pay attention to vitamin K. It should be in your multivitamin or in your bone density formula, or take it by itself. This is Food for Thought. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Are you taking the most important omega-3s? Carlson's Super Omega 3 Gems contains the omega-3s found in fish. Not only are omega-3s crucial for brain and vision development, they're also important for cardiovascular health as well. Each Carlson Super Omega 3 Gem Soft Gel supplies a full 500 milligrams of the omega-3s EPA and DHA. EPA and DHA are so important, even the American Heart Association recommends a daily dose for heart health. You can take Carlson fish oils with confidence. All Carlson fish oils are sustainably sourced and tested for purity, potency, and freshness by an independent FDA-registered laboratory. Get your Carlson Super Omega 3 Gems from your favorite natural food store today. Carlson for Kids Chewable DHA is a fun and tasty way to provide your child with the nourishing benefits of DHA omega-3 oil. DHA is vital for healthy brain and vision development in growing children. Carlson for Kids Chewable DHA is bursting with orange flavor. And each chewable soft gel supplies 100 milligrams of DHA. You can give your children Carlson for Kids Chewable DHA with confidence because all Carlson fish oils are tested for purity, potency, and freshness by an independent FDA-registered laboratory. Look for the purity guarantee right on the label. Get your Carlson for Kids Chewable DHA from your favorite natural food store today.
Welcome back. And thanks to my sponsor, Carlson Laboratories. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, 50 years in the business of making very high-quality dietary supplements that help people boost their levels of omega-3, vitamin D, the B vitamins, special formulations for vision, multivitamins for people that have metabolic syndrome, all kinds of great, great products. So I thank them for their support of my radio program. If you're a coffee drinker, there's been some good news for you in the research most recently, and there's a study that is set to be presented at the American Academy of Neurology's upcoming meeting in Washington, D.C., and another potential health benefit of coffee consumption, it might reduce the risk of multiple sclerosis. The risk of MS could be reduced by drinking at least 4 cups of coffee a day, according to the researchers. More than 2 million people worldwide have MS. It's a chronic disease of the central nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, and optic nerves. We think of it as an autoimmune disease where immune system-induced inflammation damages the protective coating of nerve fibers. Those are called myelin. Symptoms of MS are all over the place, but they include loss of balance and coordination, blurred vision, extreme fatigue. Sometimes people with MS have tremors, and a lot of people with MS experience numbness. So there have been studies in the past linking coffee consumption to other neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, but this one, and this comes from Johns Hopkins, points to a link between coffee consumption and multiple sclerosis. Two studies. One was a Swedish study, another one was an American study. They recorded coffee consumption in people with MS at a year before the onset of symptoms and also 5 years before the onset of symptoms. That was in the U.S. The Swedish study recorded coffee consumption 10 years before the onset of symptoms. And then they looked at coffee intake in people with MS compared to the healthy controls at similar time points. And the participants in the Swedish study, the participants that didn't drink coffee in the one year prior to symptom onset were 1.5 times more likely to develop MS. And the people who were large consumers of coffee at 5 and 10 years prior to the onset of symptoms were protected. In the U.S. study, the same deal. The participants that didn't drink coffee in the 1 year leading up to symptom starting of MS were 1.5 times more likely to develop MS. Now, this may all have to do with caffeine. Caffeine has neuroprotective properties. It suppresses the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines. So, this is pretty interesting. Now, we've also seen studies within the last year showing that increasing coffee intake could reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. I'm going to talk about that in a second. And also protect against tinnitus, ringing in the ears. Coffee consumption can reduce the risk of melanoma skin cancer by about 20%. And 3 to 4 cups of coffee a day can reduce the risk of endometrial cancer. Now, overdo it and you have an increased risk of depression and anxiety. So you got to find your sweet spot when it comes to coffee consumption. I don't have one. I'm not a coffee drinker. I can't handle it. It's a little too fracturing for me. It makes me frazzled. I get kind of just nervous, where tea is calming for me. So I get a little caffeine, but I get it in a calming way. Now, about that link between coffee and diabetes, this was at Harvard. Increasing coffee consumption reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes. This was reported in Medical News Today. And they actually found, this was published in the journal Diabetologia. That's a mouthful. But they looked at a 20-year period, and they looked at the participants in 3 big studies. The Brigham and Women's Hospital-Based Nurses' Health Study, the the follow-up to the nurses' health study and the men in the health professionals' follow-up study. And what they found was increasing coffee intake by more than one cup a day over a four-year period was linked with an 11% lower risk of type 2 diabetes over the subsequent 4 years compared with people who kept their coffee intake stable, and people who reduced their coffee consumption on average 2 cups per day, so a 2-cup reduction, had a 17% higher risk for type 2 diabetes. A cup of coffee was defined as 8 ounces, either black or with a small amount of milk. So coffee has health benefits, and if you love it, you should keep drinking it. Now, certainly coffee is only one of the factors that influences the risk of diabetes, and Mediterranean diet, eating a healthy diet, reducing or eliminating added sugars, increasing exercise, following the advice of increasing the numbers of servings of plant foods, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, legumes. These are all things. We have to watch our weight. We need to be physically active over and over again. We talk about this. So coffee's not the only protective element against becoming diabetic. And if you're on the path, if someone has said to you, you need to be careful, you're really starting to look like you're pre-diabetic, you know, you can turn that back around again. Increasing your activity, changing up the way that you eat, getting rid of the cakes, the cookies, the crackers, and the added sugars. You absolutely can influence your health. The human body wants to be healthy while it's alive. When you put the right things in place, we have a miraculous capacity to improve our health for the better at every age. So even if you're struggling with some issues, have hope. There's been a link emerging between inflammation in the gut health, the foods that we eat, low levels of specific nutrient intakes, and environmental and food toxins, and inflammation contributing to depression, maybe even more than having imbalances of serotonin and other brain chemicals. Depression is a serious issue. It affects about 10% of our population, but it's also a very big business. It contributes to ridiculously high profits for pharmaceutical drugs like Abilify. We see those ads every night. And chronic inflammation appears to be a major factor. So we can greatly influence our levels of inflammation. We can reduce inflammation by eating a whole food, plant-based diet. That's an anti-inflammatory diet. Removing inflammatory foods from the diet. Last week I talked about sugar and refined foods, trans fats, very high levels of omega-6 relative to omega-3. But inflammation and depression have a link, and the source of inflammation, aside from just food, could be stress, it can be toxic exposures, it can be infection. There are biomarkers of inflammation, cytokines, cellularly produced chemical compounds that are messengers, C-reactive protein, a couple of the interleukins, tumor necrosis factor alpha. Those are actually showing promise as potential new diagnostic tools because they're predictive and they're linearly related to depression. Melancholic depression, bipolar disorder, postpartum depression, all of those are associated with elevated levels of these cellular inflammatory markers and also decreased sensitivity to cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone, but it's also a buffer against the effects of inflammation. Once these inflammatory agents in the body are triggered, so the C-reactive protein, the interleukin-1, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, Once they're triggered, they transfer information to the nervous system through stimulation of major nerves like the vagus nerve, which connects the gut and the brain, and specialized cells in the brain, the microglia, which represent the brain's immune hubs, get activated in inflammatory states. And when those microglia get activated, there's an enzyme in there, indole-2,3-dioxygenase, that directs tryptophan away from the production of serotonin and melatonin and toward the production of something called quinolinic acid that is responsible for symptoms of anxiety and agitation. So these are changes that conspire to let your brain in on what your body already knows is wrong. So this is a direct link between gut and mental health. And that has been borne out in observational studies and reviews showing that depression is often found alongside gastrointestinal inflammations and autoimmune diseases, as well as with cardiovascular diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, type 2 diabetes, and in cancer. And in all those cases, chronic low-grade inflammation is a significant contributing factor. Depression may be a neuropsychiatric manifestation of a chronic inflammatory syndrome. So what do we do? Well, we can treat GI inflammation with probiotics, with the B vitamins, with vitamin D. And when we do that, we find that that improves depression symptoms. Your gut is literally your second brain. Do you know there's more serotonin, the neurotransmitter serotonin, in your gut than there is in your brain? And serotonin is associated with mood control. So optimizing the gut flora with the probiotics is part of the equation to optimize serotonin levels. So it's bad news if you consume loads of processed foods and sugars, because your gut bacteria are severely compromised. Processed foods decimate the healthy microflora in the body, and that leaves a void, and that void gets filled by disease-causing bacteria, yeast, and fungus, and that promotes inflammation, and it decreases the health of your second brain. So vitamin D deficiency and omega-3 deficiency and probiotic levels that are too low can predispose you to depression. That's the takeaway. This is Food for Thought, literally Food for Thought, and I'm your host, Jolie Root. We will be back right after these messages from my sponsor. Please stay with me.
Have you heard about Carlson Super 2 Daily? No doubt you've heard about the benefits of eating more fish, but most of us don't eat omega-3 rich fish every day. Carlson Super 2 Daily is like having a serving of light tuna when you take your multivitamin. Take your vitamins, minerals, and a dose of Heart Smart omega-3s all in one formula, two soft gels. Carlson Super 2 Daily. It's the perfect foundation for your supplement program. Carlson Super 2 Daily is a comprehensive balanced formula supplying essential vitamins and minerals in just two easy-to-swallow soft gels. Plus, Carlson Super 2 Daily provides the omega-3s, EPA, and DHA to support the heart, nerves, brain, and the eyes. Purity, potency, and freshness are always guaranteed. Look for Carlson Super 2 Daily at finer health food stores today. Have you had your Carlson Norwegian fish oil today? Decades ago, scientists discovered why Greenland Eskimos maintain healthy hearts despite their high-fat diets. The high level of omega-3 oils in their seafood diet protected their hearts. Carlson Norwegian fish oil provides those important omega-3 oils. The same omega-3s from cold water fish support maximum brain power, immune strength, joint comfort, and our vision too. Carlson, the very finest fish oil, is a valuable source of the important omega-3s, EPA and DHA. Each teaspoon provides a full 1,600 milligrams of omega-3s. And its purity is guaranteed. Try it on salads and popcorn. It tastes like lemon, not fishy. As for Carlson, the very finest fish oil at finer health food stores today.
Welcome back to Food for Thought. I'm your host, Jolie Root. I'm a nurse and I'm also a nutritionist. I'm an educator for my sponsor, Carlson Laboratories. So yes, there is a connection. And I travel all over North America, and sometimes, lucky me, I get to venture over into Europe too to attend conferences to learn about cutting-edge nutrition research and then bring it back and teach. Most of what I do involves teaching out in the community, and as you may be able to, I do love my work. I've been on the air with Food for Thought since 1987. That's kind of amazing, just in the face of that, good grief. But I do have a passion for sharing health information, and if you want to keep up with me between the radio shows, you can come to my blog. It's called Red Wine, Green Tea, and Dark Chocolate. I admit I have a fondness for. But you can find it at joliblogs.com, joliblogs.com. And the next two things that I'm going to talk about are the lead stories on the blog right now. On the blog, you'll find a link to listen to this show. If you're sitting at a computer rather than listening to the radio, you can pick up this program all over the world by being at your computer and going to the radio's website and listening live. You'll also find a link to podcasts of some of the shows that I've done. And I'm going to be loading up a bunch more of those on my podcast site this week. And you can find me on Facebook. Food for Thought Radio has a page on Facebook. And also I'm on Twitter. I am Jolie Root, J-O-L-I-E-R-O-O-T on Twitter. And I tweet health news usually early in the morning, but sometimes later in the day whenever I happen to be reading things that are tweet-worthy. This was something that definitely got my attention. This was a study that was published in The Lancet. It has to do with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Now, it's going to sound alarming, but we need to know about the difference between relative risk and absolute risk, and I'll explain that. But first, let me go ahead and give you the alarming headline. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder doubles the risk of early death. Having a diagnosis of ADHD increases the risk of death and reduces overall life expectancy. And this Lancet study found that people with ADHD have more than twice the risk of premature death, and accidents are the most common cause. Now, what I want to say right now is absolute risk just means that out of 10,000 people who don't have ADHD, the death from all causes was 2 in 10,000. But in 10,000 people with ADHD, it was 6. So it was a more than double rise in the mortality rate ratio in people with ADHD. But what we're talking about is the difference of 2 in 10,000 or 6 in 10,000. So I want to make the numbers real so that you don't think that every child with attention deficit is in danger of dropping out. It's not, and by dropping out, I mean dying early. But accidents are the most common cause for people with ADHD, and also there was a higher risk for people that didn't receive a diagnosis until they were adults. So I mentioned earlier when we were talking about ADHD in the first segment that boys are 4 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed, and that children are typically diagnosed between the ages of 3 and 6. But attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder are sometimes lifelong conditions. And so what this study is showing is an increase in likelihood of dying, particularly accidentally. So if you were not diagnosed until you were 18 or older, your likelihood of early death is four times that of counterparts your same age who don't have ADHD. Children diagnosed before the age of six were at double the risk of death compared to children without ADHD. But again, remember that the numbers are small, so there's no reason to go running and screaming. However, there were some very interesting findings. Women were more likely to be affected. So what happens with ADHD? There's oppositional defiant disorder, there's conduct disorder, and there's substance use disorder, and that's risky behavior. So again, the relative risk and the absolute risk need to be kept in mind. It's not that a high number of people with ADHD are dying early. It's just that the absolute risk is higher than in people who don't have it. But it brings up some points. This is not to freak you out, all this talk of premature death, but the validity of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as a medical disorder has been challenged for a very long time. And what we need to do is allocate a fair share of healthcare and research resources to people who have this condition. We need to pay attention to the fact that the condition is on the rise and that it can be dangerous. ADHD is a common neurodevelopmental disorder. It causes impairment across the lifespan. This was just the first study to note that the disorder itself is also associated with increased mortality, and that being highest in individuals diagnosed in adulthood. So what could the causal link be? Well, the researchers said one pathway follows attention deficit hyperactivity's well-known risks for oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder because of an increased risk when you have those, the oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder, there's an increased risk of antisocial disorders that increase the risk of violence and crime, of substance use, which leads to accidents and fighting, and also inattention and impulsivity, which increases the risk of accidents and poor health habits, and risky behaviors that lead to health risks and accidents. But ADHD alone, there are features of that disorder that can directly increase the risk of accidents. Inattention and impulsivity, those affect driving, and risky behaviors where the individuals are increasing sensation seeking. So that can lead to substance abuse. So it just is important for us to pay attention to the reality of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and look for patterns. Look for patterns of behavior that increase the likelihood of a child being impacted by that disorder. Because before conception, parents need to pay attention to things like omega-3 and vitamin D status, because the expression of genes that impact the formation of the brain and the function of the brain and enzymatic reactions within the brain, the expression of those genes are governed by things like vitamin D status. So there was another paper that was published this year, and it's the lead story on my blog right now. It's something that I think is really fascinating. This is Children's Hospital, UC Berkeley, Doctors Patrick and Ames. Bruce Ames, a well-known antioxidant researcher, they have published a paper, and it's discussing implications of their finding that vitamin D regulates the conversion of the essential amino acid tryptophan into serotonin. This paper was published in 2014, and that this could influence the development of autism, particularly in developing children with poor vitamin D status. But the paper that they've just published actually then brings in another nutrient favorite of mine, omega-3 fatty acids, together with vitamin D. And the paper says omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D may control brain serotonin affecting behavior and psychiatric disorders, so not just autism. So in the newer paper, they're discussing the importance of omega-3s and vitamin D for neuropsychiatric illness. Serotonin affects a wide range of cognitive function, not just mood, but also decision-making, social behavior, impulsive behavior, and even social decision-making, keeping in check aggressive social responses. So autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and depression all share as a unifying attribute low levels of brain serotonin. So in this new piece of research, they're explaining how serotonin is a critical modulator of executive function, impulse control, sensory gating, and pro-social behavior. They link serotonin production and function to vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acids, suggesting how important these micronutrients are to supporting brain function and affecting the way that we behave. So, for example, eicosapentaenoic acid, it's EPA, it's one of the omega-3s. It increases serotonin release from presynaptic neurons by reducing inflammatory signaling molecules in the brain, the E2 series prostaglandins. Those inhibit serotonin release, and this suggests that inflammation may negatively impact serotonin in the brain. Now, EPA is not the only omega-3 that plays a role in the serotonin pathway. DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, also influences various serotonin receptors by making them more accessible to serotonin by increasing the fluidity in cell membranes in the postsynaptic neurons. And this paper also talks about the mechanistic links that explain why low vitamin D, which is mostly produced by the skin when it's exposed to sunlight, and marine omega-3 deficiencies interact with the genetic pathways like the serotonin pathway. They're important for brain development, social cognition, decision making, and how these gene micronutrient interactions influence neuropsychiatric outcomes. Vitamin D is converted to a steroid hormone that controls about 1,000 genes, many in the brain. And it's a major deficiency in the U.S. Omega-3 fatty acid deficiencies are also very common because people don't eat enough fish. So optimizing intakes of vitamin D, EPA, and DHA will optimize brain serotonin concentrations, possibly preventing and ameliorating some of the symptoms associated with these psychiatric disorders. Very interesting stuff. Stay with me, one more break, and then I'll be back with one more segment of Food for Thought.
No doubt you've heard a lot about the health benefits of vitamin D. Now you can get your vitamin D in a base of the healthiest omega-3s. Carlson Solar D Gems provides both. Carlson Solar D Gems provides 2,000 to 4,000 IU of all-natural vitamin D3, a vitamin that many people do not get enough of from the sun alone. In fact, many health experts are now claiming that most Americans are lacking in this important nutrient. Vitamin D3 plays an important role in bone, cardiovascular, and immune health. Plus, Carlson Solar D Gems also contains the important omega-3 oils that your body needs to support vision, brain function, and a healthy heart. The omega-3s support the absorption of the vitamin D. You get the benefits of both. Carlson Solar D Gems, vitamin D in a base of omega-3s. Look for Carlson Solar D Gems at your favorite natural food store today. Concerned about diabetes? Carlson NutriSupport Diabetes is a unique formula containing nutrients that support the health of individuals with diabetes or pre-diabetes. two easy-to-swallow soft gels supply over 25 nutrients, including important omega-3s from fish oil. Carlson Nutri-Support Diabetes supports a healthy heart, brain, and nerves, healthy vision, and healthy circulation. Ask for Carlson Nutri-Support Diabetes at finer health food stores today. Or go to carlsonlabs.com to find the location of the store nearest you. Carlson Nutri-Support Diabetes. Ask for it today.
Welcome back to Food for Thought. I'm your host, Jolie Root. And we've been talking about the brain quite a lot in the program today. And so there was a very interesting study. It was a systematic analysis published in a journal called Epidemiology. It was a review that found that the Mediterranean diet may have cognitive benefits. So sticking with a Mediterranean diet pattern has been found to be associated with better cognitive functions and lower rates of cognitive decline. And what they found was a very positive impact on cognitive function. They looked at 12 eligible pieces of research. 11 of them were observational studies, and one was a randomized controlled trial. Higher adherence to a Mediterranean diet was associated with better cognitive function, lower rates of cognitive decline, and a reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease. So Mediterranean food is delicious, it's nutritious, and it looks like it protects the aging brain by reducing the risk of dementia. So the details were looking at all of these different studies and then looking at people who actually followed the advice to adopt a Mediterranean diet. And they need to do probably some randomized controlled trials to see if prevention of Alzheimer's disease with Mediterranean diet is possible. But in the meantime, you don't have to wait. And if you go to my blog, JolieBlogs.com, if you go over on the right hand of that page, there's a word cloud and there's a little link for Mediterranean diet. There are also some pages that are specifically set up to help explain the Mediterranean diet and how you can incorporate a Mediterranean diet approach into your pattern of eating. So it's a diet that features fish more often than poultry, really kind of very infrequent servings of red meat, cooking with olive oil, lots of fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, whole grains, dairy products, and also nuts and legumes. So no refined and processed convenience foods. It's a cooking from scratch kind of diet with fresh and wholesome foods. It's very easy to incorporate the principles of the Mediterranean diet into your lifestyle. And of course, I believe in the evidence-based supplementation of very bioactive compounds like vitamin D, the omega-3s, and other supplements that are shown to be beneficial. In the weeks that come, I'm going to be talking about a new modified form of resveratrol, because another component in the Mediterranean diet is red wine. Red wine, green tea, and dark chocolate. That's my blog. The red wine, not consumed to excess, but a glass a day, is associated with so many different health benefits. And there are compounds in red wine, in red grapes, in blueberries that are the polyphenol antioxidant compounds. Resveratrol gets talked about, but there's an activated form of resveratrol called pterostilbene. It's featured in one of my favorite Carlson products. It's called Heart Fit. It's a combination product that improves heart muscle tone, and the pterostilbene is in there. But pterostilbene is just one of those bioactive compounds that I think is worth taking a look at, as far as supplements are concerned. So following the Mediterranean diet, bringing healthy aging of the brain. Now, there's another compound I don't talk about that often, and it surrounds me here at my home in Florida. It's pine bark extract. We love pine trees because in the winter they're green. It's one of those trees that's green all year long. But pine bark and pine needles have been used by indigenous people for centuries for nutrition and general wellness. And there's an extract from the bark of the French maritime pine that has compounds that have year-round life-enhancing benefits. The compounds are proanthocyanidins. And the ones that are derived from pine bark have been associated with a variety of benefits, including protecting our DNA, reducing inflammation, decreasing oxidative stress, and reducing glycation. Glycation is the damage that happens to the tissues and organs in our body from exposure to sugar, from high levels of blood sugar, and exposure to cooking protein foods like red meat at very high heat. So DNA protection, reduction of inflammation, antioxidant protection, reducing glycation, these are broad benefits of pine bark extract. But pine bark extract has been found to do things like reduce the length and severity of the common cold, decreasing symptoms associated with psoriasis. And not just psoriasis, pine bark extract benefits the skin of healthy people too. It protects collagen from degrading. It reduces damage caused by ultraviolet light, which is the primary cause of skin aging. It improves skin's elasticity, and roughness and hydration are improved, and even hyperpigmentation, those age spots that we all cringe when they start popping up in the mirror when we look. It improves circulation. In studies involving people with chronic venous insufficiency, pine bark extract reduced leg and ankle swelling and improved symptoms. And maintaining capillary health, pine bark extract really supports the health of blood vessels, both large and very, very tiny. And pine bark extract is one of those things that we can use to combat spider veins, the little dilated red or violet capillaries that show up sometimes in the legs of people that stand on high heels for long periods of time, working in retail professions, and people that wear very tight clothing get spider veins. Pine bark extract can be used during menopause, hot flashes, and reducing fatigue. Just 100 milligrams over an 8-week period reduced fatigue, sleep issues, memory impairment, dizziness, irritability, and depression. This was in women that were going through menopause. Also reduced symptoms of headache, breast tenderness, and even itching. So that's pretty good. That was 100 milligrams over an 8-week period of pine bark extract. Pine bark extract has also shown promise for other chronic diseases such as diabetes. Diabetics got a daily dose of 125 milligrams of pine bark extract, and they had an average reduction of almost 24 milligrams per deciliter in fasting blood sugar levels. Hemoglobin A1C, which assesses long-term blood sugar control, and LDL cholesterol were also significantly reduced. Arthritis was another situation where pine bark extract played a very strong role daily. There was a 100 milligram dose resulting in a 56% reduction in symptoms and an increase in walking distance in individuals with arthritis. So pine bark extract, another supplement with a very strong history of protective benefit, something for you to consider. 100 milligrams a day, or even 125 milligrams a day. Now, as if we don't complain enough about the Western diet has been found to contribute to global warming, climate change. It's an interesting link. This comes out of a think tank in the UK, and what they're saying is that the Western diet is incompatible with our international targets to avoid climate disaster. And they say too little is being done to limit global meat and dairy consumption in light of its impact on climate change. So if you're a climate person, if this is something that concerns you, the choices that we make in the foods that we eat have an impact on carbon emissions. And in fact, the cows themselves have a pretty big impact on carbon emissions. Emissions from livestock, according to an analysis in this Chatham House UK think tank analysis of increasing carbon emissions linked to dietary patterns, the analysis put emissions from livestock at 14.5% of the global total. That's a big number. Now, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization said 18% in their report in 2006. The report was called Livestock's Long Shadow. You can Google that. You can read that UN FAO report. Livestock's Long Shadow is available on the internet if you're interested in taking a look at how livestock contributes to emissions. But this UK think tank took a look at consumer perceptions of climate change and the recognition that livestock was a big contributor to carbon emissions was the lowest among the many different things that were linked to, you know, the obvious contributors to the carbon emissions. But meat and dairy consumption is set to grow rapidly in the next 40 years. It's unlikely that we can stay at a 2% increase in global temperature by having a meat and dairy-centric diet. So just knowing that dietary trends need to be included as part of an international strategy to reduce carbon emissions is just, it's something to pay attention to. So if there's another good reason to have Meatless Monday or to adhere to more of a Mediterranean diet pattern, the warming of the earth is another good reason. That's it for this week and Food for Thought. I'll be back with you again next Friday with another edition of the program. In the meantime, stay happy and stay healthy. Take care. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Food for Thought with Jolie Root, sponsored by Carlson Laboratories. Tune in again next time as Jolie Root sifts through medical research and expert opinions for practical advice to help you take control of your health naturally and live well every day. Food for Thought, Fridays at 10 a.m. on 1160 WVNJ.